Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from September 23, 2017. This talk is the fifth of a series of talks on karma and rebirth. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So today's the fifth of a series of, I think it's going to be six talks on karma and rebirth. Just to recap, karma is not some overarching spiritual system of reward and punishment. It's not anything that's imposed on us by any outside force. We are responsible, and we're also the beneficiaries of our karma. Karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present level or quality of our mindfulness. And what that means is, if we are developing the Eightfold Path and we're developing a well-concentrated mind and we're developing the framework of that Eightfold Path, we will be inclining our actions. Karma means actions. We'll be inclining our actions towards awakening rather than continuing our own ignorance of karma and Four Noble Truths. The Buddha described karma this way in relation to Four Noble Truths. Karma should be understood. The cause of karma should be recognized and abandoned. The cessation of karma should be experienced, and the path developing the cessation of karma is the Eightfold Path. That relates directly to how he described dukkha. In fact, in exactly the same terms, dukkha should be understood. The cause of dukkha, craving and clinging, should be recognized and abandoned. The cessation of dukkha should be understood, and the path leading to the cessation of dukkha is the Eightfold Path. Dukkha means every type of minor disappointment all the way to extreme suffering. So karma is all of that. The significance of the teaching of karma is to show that we have the ability within us, and you could say that it's our responsibility to recognize and abandon the cause of our own distress or stress in our life. Over the years, most of modern Buddhism has either misinterpreted karma and has created this idea of it's a reward and punishment system, or has said that the Buddha didn't teach. He only taught karma to relate to the common teachings of his time, meaning that karma was taught, and it was, but not in the way the Buddha taught it. The Buddha taught it in a much different way. The way karma was presented even during the Buddha's time was more or less as a system of reward and punishment. And it was often taught as a zero-sum game. In other words, if you smack somebody in the nose five times, somebody's going to smack you in the nose five times. And it's really none of that. No matter what our intentional actions and the result of those actions are in this present moment, we are in control of how that will play out in our lives. And mostly what that relates to, in fact, entirely what it relates to, is our thinking in this present moment, because that's how we're going to experience anything. So, is that clear so far, what I just said? I mean, it's just kind of a recap of what we've been talking about.
John?
Yes.
You said we're in control.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
We're in control of our experience, no matter what it is. And certainly, as our life unfolds, we're in control of how we react or respond to that. And that relates directly to a well-concentrated mind, but also seeing things as they occur in relation to the Eightfold Path, which ultimately means seeing things from right view. So that's what I mean when we're in control. So the object of what's occurring in this moment is not the result of something I did a moment ago, sometime in my past life, or if you want to take it into past lives, going back forever. That has nothing to do with it. But because of conditioned thinking, I might make an attachment to it, or it seems like the same thing keeps coming up in our lives, the same issue. And we'll often say, well, that's karma. It only seems like it's the same issue because our reaction to it is the same. Our minds are conditioned to respond or react in a certain way. But the objects are always changing, and the unfoldment of that is always changing. You know, there's always, just to give you a good example, and I know I've given it before in this talk, Angulimala the murderer was this, a contemporary of the Buddha, And he was so enamored with his own ability to kill people that he cut their fingers off and he made a necklace out of their bloody fingers and he wore it around. He had 99 at one time. And he's walking down the road and he sees the Buddha coming towards him. He says, that's number 100. And there's a long story about how he had a difficult time even approaching the Buddha, but I won't get into that. He finally catches up to the Buddha, intent on killing him, but all of a sudden that feeling just left and the Buddha very briefly taught him the Dhamma. And he never killed another soul. And he also didn't have to suffer 99 deaths because of the 99 people that he killed. Modern interpretations of karma would say, well, he's supposed to. Well, he's not. Because his thinking had changed. He was no longer suffering from that same conditioned thinking, which is really the cause of his own hell, wasn't it? Think about the quality of Angulimala's mind. He created his own suffering from that obsession with having to keep killing people. That was his hell. That was his punishment. It wasn't so much what he was doing with people. It was what he had done to his own mind by creating that obsession to have to kill. And we do that with all types of things. So I always use chocolate cake as an example. I can set the wheel of karma in motion by deciding that I need chocolate cake to be happy. I need to have one big piece of chocolate cake every day or my life isn't worth living. And one day comes along and I don't get it and I'm disappointed. I might even be irate. Who ate my chocolate cake? That's my karma unfolding, but it's not because of the chocolate cake or not getting the chocolate cake. It's my reaction to it, isn't it? That's my karma in that moment, what we think. So thanks for the question. Sorry for the long answer. At Savatthi, the Buddha said, monks, what a person wills, what they plan, what they dwell on, forms the basis for the continuation of consciousness rooted in ignorance, what we dwell upon. This basis being present, consciousness has a lodgment, has a place to live, it has a home. Consciousness being lodged there and growing, rebirth of renewed existence takes place in the future, and from this renewed existence arise birth, decay, and death, grief, lamentation, or regret, suffering, sorrow, and despair. Such is the uprising of this entire mass of suffering. He's in that paragraph, he's describing how each and every moment, because of consciousness rooted in ignorance, having a lodgment, having a place in our lives, can only give birth to another moment rooted in that ignorance. So the Buddha is not really, not significantly talking about a future birth, although that's part of it. It's really an unimportant part of it. What are we giving birth to in this moment? And that relates to how we're thinking, what we're holding in mind. If we're holding in mind, and if that mind is well concentrated, and holding in mind the factors of the Eightfold Path, our mind is inclined towards awakening and away from creating more confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. Is that clear? Because it's at that point that we can practice restraint and start diminishing our karma, the momentum behind our past actions, or through ignorance, continue that process of a life rooted in ignorance. The Buddha continues, even if a person does not will and plan, yet if they dwell on something, this forms the basis for continuation of consciousness. Rebirth takes place. So what the Buddha is really saying there is if we don't have control of our mind, even if we're not, if we're living a very unstructured life, and growing up in the 60s is a good example of that. You know, everything has to be free. We can't. That was just another example of creating an identity over freedom, wasn't it? There wasn't any real freedom there. I don't make any plans. I'm open there. Well, there's an identity. The Buddha recognized that even 2,600 years ago. There were a bunch of hippies back then, I think, too.
John, can I say one funny quote I heard yesterday? Somebody asked Ajahn Tomato, well, shouldn't I just follow my heart? And he goes, absolutely not. That's what got you here in the first place. He said, and once you train and understand how the heart, like the mind works, you know, that will, then you can follow it skillfully. But I thought it was a...
Yeah, that's why the Buddha gave us an Eightfold Path. So we don't follow our heart, we follow the path.
Absolutely not.
But if a person neither wills nor plans nor dwells on anything, meaning what he's saying specifically there is not clinging to anything and not craving for anything to remain the same. If a person neither wills nor plans nor dwells on anything, no basis is formed for the continuation of consciousness rooted in ignorance. When the Buddha described an awakened human being, it described them as unbound or released from clinging. He's saying the same thing right here. This basis being absent, consciousness has no lodgment. It has no place. It has no home in our minds. And again, remember the Buddha's talking. He's not talking about now we have no consciousness. We can't think anymore. He's talking about consciousness rooted in ignorance. That ongoing thinking, that conditioned thinking, has no lodgment. There's nothing for it to attach to. Again, related to the description of an awakened human being. We're not clinging to ignorant views. We're not clinging to wrong views. We see things clearly. And now again, remember, this is in relation to talking about karma and rebirth. A mind that is that pure can no longer give birth to anything that would be stressful or disappointing. And the normal occurrences of life, remember how the Buddha first described suffering, birth, sickness, aging, and death. That very basic experience of life is simply experienced as having a human life. It's not right or wrong. We're not enamored with it, but we have no aversion to any of those qualities. In fact, the only enamoration, in fact, if that's a word, would come from recognizing from birth to death, we have this incredible opportunity to awaken. That's the point. Moore and I had an interesting talk, and I don't know if I won't mention that little quote that you gave. We spend our whole lives doing things that are mostly fruitless in the sense that we're born here, we die there. And there's nothing of real value before or after, is there? At least we don't think there is. The Buddha says there isn't. In the middle, the most important thing we can do is awaken. If not, or we'll do it, or the Buddhist word is wandering in samsara. But it's like a dog chasing our tail, aren't we? If we spend our whole life in competition and acquisition, trying to get things to prove what a wonderful person I am to myself and to the world, we're missing the whole point. I don't agree with everything the Dalai Lama said, but I agree with one thing that he said. The purpose of time is to awaken. Another way of saying that, the purpose of time is to recognize and abandon the cause of our own karma. What else is of any real value here, isn't it? I mean, for those of us that have an understanding of the general unsatisfactory nature of life, that last phrase has a meaning. What else would be the point? We all came here, we came to a so-called spiritual practice, just to put a big umbrella on it, because we felt like something was missing in life, something was disappointing or unsatisfactory about the way we're living our lives. So we started looking for another way. That other way is completely understanding the nature of that unsatisfactory nature. That's what the Buddha recognized. And karma is simply the unfolding, the present moment unfolding, of that unsatisfactory nature of life, moderated now by a right view. Let me continue. This is why this has taken 7 weeks, because I talked to you.
And John,
it's going to go on too long. Comments afterwards. Thank you, Mark. Even if a person does not will and plan, yet if they dwell on something, this forms the basis for the continuation of consciousness. I'm sorry, I just read that twice. Well, let me just finish that. But if a person neither wills nor plans nor dwells on anything, no basis is formed for the continuation of consciousness. This basis being absent, consciousness has no lodgment. Consciousness not being lodged there, consciousness not being lodged there, meaning within, and not growing, no rebirth of renewed existence takes place in the future. And again, the Buddha is not talking necessarily in future lives, in the next moment. And so birth, decay, death, grief, regret, suffering, sorrow, and despair are destroyed. Such is the cessation of this entire mass of suffering. We've ended dukkha in our lives by ending our karma. My words, notice how this last passage relates to dependent origination. Remember that all of these teachings are to develop understanding of confusion and suffering and the cessation of future confusion and suffering, or our future karma unfolding. It's the whole point. By gaining wisdom, one no longer acts from ignorance. With no ignorance, there is no basis for the establishment of mental fabrications or discriminating and discursive consciousness. With no consciousness established in ignorance, there is nothing to sustain the five clinging aggregates, the Buddha's description of the personal experience of suffering. With no sustenance, the 12 links of dependent origination unbind. We're not feeding ignorance anymore with our own thinking, our own deluded thinking.
So may I ask a question?
Yes.
So just going back the two links before, I can't recall anything, but there's no discursive thinking. Could you just read that one time?
Sure. With no ignorance, now remember, dependent origination, from ignorance to 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering, all manner of dukkha, all manner of karma arises. With no ignorance, there is no basis for the establishment of mental fabrications or discriminating and discursive consciousness.
Okay, so my question is, what are other thoughts if they're not mental fabrications? What's the difference between mental fabrications and discursive thinking and thinking that is not rooted in ignorance?
Yeah, mental fabrications and discursive thinking are all really the same thing.
Right, but what's the difference between that and thinking?
Seeing things clearly self-referential views.
So mental fabrications and discursive thinking, the nature of them is self-referential views. So there can be intelligent thought when you're awakened, but the definition of discursive thinking, mental fabrications, are deluded thought.
Deluded because they're rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And remember the link from ignorance.
Right.
Mental fabrications require that initial ignorance. Mental fabrications are assumptions that we make about ourselves in relation to the world that are rooted in that ignorance.
So
anything that follows from that is rooted in ignorance or it's deluded thinking.
Sure. So I that part I thought I understand, but all of a sudden I realized, so what do you call thinking when it comes from an awakened wisdom perspective?
When that question was put to the Buddha, this was his answer, because he's implying that the question itself is rooted in ignorance, and I'll explain. And I'm not saying you're ignorant. Ignorance of Four Noble Truths.
I'm ignorant.
So because the question is seeking to establish a self beyond awakening, when that is this continued eye making. It's the same thing as, it's the same question as saying, do I exist after death? Am I infinite or finite? Of course, the obvious response, especially when a Buddha is sitting in front of you, is there's a reference point in the world. And that ongoing thinking is rooted in wisdom. It's seeing things clearly. But it's not a continuation of an ignorant self that now somehow is...
Right.
That ignorant self is like...
The term of that, because thinking still continues, so...
That's where the Buddha's sitting like that, because when we get hooked on terms, you have to be able to communicate. In some, we use words and we use conceptual frameworks. But a self-referential ego self wants to use those words to establish an I, rather than just recognize, look very clearly what the Buddha is teaching. Let go of your discursive thinking. Let go of your assumptions rooted in ignorance, and those questions won't arise anymore. They're irrelevant questions.
And then supposedly you would experience this thing or this thought, but you would accept it as not really having a need for a word to describe it.
Yes, because thank you for the question. It's important. It's the same basic question with, okay, I buy all this. I think this is the greatest teachings in the world. I'm going to do it, but what happens to me?
Well, I wasn't thinking about what happens to me. I was thinking about what do you call what the Buddha taught? That's what I was thinking about. I don't really care what I'm thinking.
Well, the Buddha taught the Dhamma. That's what it's called. Because it's a path out of that discursive thinking.
But
you find that an unsatisfying answer.
No, I don't find it an unsatisfactory I don't find it an unsatisfactory answer at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
That, but that, thank you for
just that. I just had a question. Well, this is called discursive thinking, mental corporations, but then there's still thinking on the other hand, or there's connected speech and ideas still form. So I just had reflection. What's the difference between the two of them?
Yeah, one is
not from my
one is rooted in ignorance, and one is rooted in awakening. When you read the Buddha suttas, it's remarkable there's not a wasted word. Why? Because he's not trying to continue to establish himself. He's just teaching the Dhamma. That's the word for it. With no consciousness established in ignorance, there is nothing to sustain the five clinging aggregates. I'm just rereading this to get back into it. With no sustenance, the 12 links of dependent origination unbind. They just fall apart. With no sustenance, a moment free of delusion, confusion, and unsatisfactoriness, a moment free of dukkha is born. The whole point. There will be no more birth rooted in ignorance and subject to endless confusion and suffering. That directly points to the importance of understanding rebirth as it relates to the Dhamma. The Buddha, again, is not talking about doing something so we avoid some future physical birth. We will no longer give birth to any moment rooted in ignorance. It will have no sustenance. There'll be no discursive thinking in that moment. Lasting peace and happiness has been established through the Eightfold Path. Unlike most religions, these are my words again, including many modern Buddhist religions, acting to gain favorable future experiences post-physical death is contrary to the Dhamma. As has been seen, birth is the beginning of the experience of the whole mass of suffering, as confusion and unsatisfactoriness is the underlying pervasive experience of life in the phenomenal world. The ending of karma and the cessation of future birth is the purpose of the Dhamma. So that points to another common misunderstanding, somewhat common anyway, that once your karma is ended, you just kind of vanish, you poof, you're gone from the planet. And that has nothing to do with karma. The Buddha awakened. He no longer was subject to the results of his karma, but he didn't vanish. He spent the next 45 years of his life living probably the most important and effective human life anybody ever lived, free of creating any more karma, free of a disturbance caused by his past actions, because he saw things clearly. It kind of relates to Moore's question, too. His thinking simply wasn't rooted in ignorance. There was no self-referential. There's no need to continue this eye-making. Awakened mind settled in equanimity will produce no additional karma. As no additional karma is created, residual karma will simply ripen and fall away until complete liberation and freedom is realized. And so what does that mean? It means that there's still momentum caused by some of the things we've done in our lives that will unfold. But no matter what they are, no matter how they ripen or manifest in our lives, with an awakened, well-concentrated mind, we simply won't react to that. And so we won't create conditioned thinking. Another way of saying that is we are free of the condition of recurring karma. There's no conditioning left in our mind. Another way of saying karma, the ending of karma, is the ending of a conditioned way of looking at the world. I make it. The three defining characteristics of the phenomenal world are anicca, dukkha, and anatta, impermanent suffering, and the not-self characteristic. Within the environment of impermanence, dukkha arises. Dukkha arises due to clinging, craving, and aversion. Clinging arises from a misunderstanding of the nature of self, in other words, from ignorance. What arises as self, what the Buddha taught is anatta, not a self, because of those views, is an impermanent combination of factors known as the five clinging aggregates. These aggregates are described as clinging due to the nature of self to cling to thoughts, views, ideas, and objects that further define and describe ourselves. It is craving and clinging rooted in ignorance that establishes a self and creates karma and the cycles of rebirth. Anatta, or not-self, refers to the impermanent nature of the formation of a self that is subject to stress, disappointment, and confusion. So this thing that is prone to stress and suffering is a formation of our own ignorance, ignorance of Four Noble Truths. We put this thing together. And the reason why that's important and why it relates to karma and rebirth is we are responsible for giving birth to this anatta, this thing that is deluded by wrong views. And because it's something that is deluded by wrong views, no matter how substantial or permanent we think it is, it's like foam on the ocean. There's nothing really there. And again, then the question might be, well, what happens? Where am I? We're just talking. This is the difficult part because these are self-referential views. We're just talking about a wrong view. What happens when we let go of all those wrong views? Well, the reference point for those wrong views doesn't vanish. Again, look at the Buddha. What we're talking about is a system of recognizing and abandoning deluded, confused thinking. Remember the sutta a few weeks ago, the Anyasota Sutta, where the Buddha talks, it's much more difficult. Let me rephrase it. It's much easier to recognize suffering in relation to the human body as it is to relate it to our own thoughts. Because it's our own thoughts that the lodgment of consciousness has taken place. And so rather than believe the physical reality of life, meaning the discreteness of all things, the arising and passing away of all things, because we've created a permanent scenario in our consciousness, we think that's what it is. We think that's our reality. The brilliance that the Buddha awakened to, that it's our thinking that's screwed up, that's wrong views. And it's our thinking that will continue to create incredibly intricate strategies. The more I'm doing this, the more I realize how pervasive this is, creating incredibly intricate strategies to ignore its own ignorance. In fact, you could really say that most of what we've created in the world is an incredibly powerful system to continue ignorance. That's what the Buddha awakened to. That's what he spent a few weeks... Excuse me. Whenever I get this excited, I start drooling. That's why he spent the 2 weeks post his awakening considering how can I teach something that I know is the truth, that I know will liberate everyone. How can I get past that initial ignorance, that confused, deluded thinking? Because it's so powerful. Because even when the Dhamma is right in front of you, you'll create strategies why it can't possibly work. Because that anatta, this self-referential thing that is rooted in nothingness, will do anything to maintain itself. It'll do anything to continue to ignore ignorance. That really is the sole purpose for the Eightfold Path. And if you look at each factor of the Eightfold Path, let me just see where I am. I wanted to get to a certain point. I think I'm going to finish there. And we'll either finish next week or the week after, but we're getting into the rebirth part. The whole issue of suffering in the world, when you really understand what the Buddha was teaching, has nothing to do with the inherent suffering in the world. In other words, birth, sickness, aging, and death are part of living in the world, aren't they? There's nothing we can do about that. Not getting what we want is going to be stressful. Getting what we don't want will be stressful. Living within this five clinging aggregates as a personal experience of suffering is ongoing stressfulness. It's an ongoing unsatisfactory experience. We can't do anything about that until we address the problem directly. And the problem isn't sickness, aging, and death. The problem isn't not getting what we want all the time. The problem isn't getting what we don't want occasionally, or some people say that the life feels like that's all the time. The problem really isn't being stuck in this vehicle of five clinging aggregates. The problem is how we think about these things. But because we've created a conditioned way of thinking, a conditioned response, you remember Pavlov's dog. You know, that's just a very good example of an experiment they did many, many years ago. I can't remember how. I think it was in the 1800s, where he saw this conditioned response through dogs, right, Bodes? But we do it. And if we have, if we're stuck in condition, in that conditioned response, in the Pavlovian response, think about that. How else can you respond to the world except from that Pavlovian response, from that conditioned response? But if we can recognize our own conditioning through the Eightfold Path, through a mind that is well concentrated, and just to make the point, it's why the Buddha didn't teach meditation for any other reason except to deepen our concentration so that we could support the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path and recognize the result of our thinking. And so once we can recognize the craving and clinging that our thinking is rooted in and start practicing restraint, and eventually, and it can happen rather quickly, abandon that craving and clinging rooted in ignorance, we are now an awakened human being. We're free of that disturbance. And when you look at, maybe you won't agree with this statement, but when we look at it that way, it's incredibly simple and direct, isn't it? Do you all agree with that? That the system itself is simple and direct? Does anybody not agree with it? But it doesn't imply that it's easy, does it? And why is it difficult? Why do we even within modern Buddhism create all types of strategies to continue to ignore ignorance? Because that not self-characteristic is that tenacious. Because it firmly believes that this is all that I am. And when you have a mindset that is conditioned that way, it is initially very difficult to start letting it go. But as you begin the process, and I would say everybody in this room has had this experience, as you start recognizing the results of your own confusion and deluded thinking in relation to the Eightfold Path, it becomes, I can say easier, but it becomes more direct and understandable, doesn't it? You're able to have the experience that, yes, what I'm doing is useful. I'm actually diminishing the effects of my past actions. I'm diminishing my karma. And that gives you some enthusiasm, enthos, inspired to continue, doesn't it? We realize that this works. So. That's the end of today's talk. We'll finish up next week, I think, maybe two more weeks. But thank you. Any questions about this talk today, and then we'll go around the room? Okay. Young lady, I forgot your name. I'm sorry.
Margaret.
2 weeks in a row. I'll try not to forget it again. Welcome, and how was your meditation, and do you have any questions, Margaret?
It was great, and I have no questions.
I'm glad you're here this morning. Tim, good to see you. How are you?
Good to see you, Jack. Good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking. Any questions or comments?
No, I need to process this.
Okay. I'm glad you're here. Anthony, good to see you.
Good morning. I've been incorporating a little bit of metta and loving kindness into my daily practice over the last 2 weeks, and I find it very helpful with conditioned thinking.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, from the news and all this political discourse and everything, I think we've accumulated, you know, bad vibes. And,
oh, yeah.
And compassion brings the other side. It sort of balances you. And I think it's particularly helpful when you're a lawyer who fights with other lawyers and insurance adjusters all day, because you can feel that, express some empathy for people
yeah.
that you may disagree with. But we all have our own lawyers and insurance adjusters. So I just think it's a great practice. I wanted to share that because I think it's very helpful with conditioned thinking.
Oh, absolutely.
Actually, more like conditioned feeling.
Yeah. thank you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I wanted to also ask you a question.
Sure.
I know the difference between rebirth and reincarnation, but is reincarnation a belief in any of the Buddhist traditions?
Oh, it's prevalent in many of them. In fact, you could say that all the Tibetan, well, I mean, there's all of the main Tibetan Buddhist religions rely on rebirth, reincarnation.
But it's not a belief in the Theravada.
Yes and no. A strict Theravadan would not believe in reincarnation, but modern Theravadan Buddhism, I don't know what the right word, it's become a little mixed up with all the other Buddhist religions today. So.
But according to the Pali Canon...
according to what the Buddha taught.
No.
There's no... Well, there's no... There can be... just to clarify it briefly, reincarnation would be the belief that an individual being as a soul is the same being that would migrate from life to life to life.
Contradictory to this I'm making.
So, rebirth is something else, and even though the Buddha talked about future births, what he was emphasizing was the importance of what you're giving birth to in the next moment.
Yeah, that's how I understand it. Not like you're going to turn into a butterfly in your next life.
Yeah, and that was a common belief of the Buddha's time and still today, that you could actually be reborn as an animal. You know, that's one of the in some Tibetan schools, that unskillful lives would lead you to be born as a dog or something.
It's a form of control.
Bodhi's got it.
It's a form of control that governments and religions can use. If you don't behave a certain way, you will wind up like that.
Well, that's a common, again, I'm not putting down religions, but that's a common aspect of many religions, that you're going to be punished for your actions in a future life, or you might not, you know, St. Peter's at the gate, you screwed up, you're going down there. And maybe that's all true. You know, I'm not saying it's not, because I don't know. It would be ignorant of me to say there's no possible way that there's St. Peter and, you know, how do I know? But the point is that
that's an egotistical view to think it that seems there's to me some that, man in a flowery white robe that's going to judge you.
As far as it relates, yes, to awakening in this human life, that's just, to me, that's more eye making. But again, the Buddha never said there's no such thing as, you know, whatever you might want to call it, the creator of the universe or supreme beings. He just said it's not important as far as awakening. What's occurring right now?
It's a distraction for awakening.
Yeah, it is. It's a very good strategy to ignore, in a lot of ways, your own karma, your own responsibility for what's going on, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. You know?
It's a prime. It's one of the prime strategies.
It can be, I mean, and it's used that way. Look at
when you think that somebody else is going to intervene for you, or something else is going to intervene, then I don't have to do all the work, or I might do work in some particular way, so I gain favor from being ridiculous. I think it's quite a prime strategy.
It is, and you create all types of excuses. Look at the, I mean, I always, when I think about this, the extremes would be the Crusades or the modern jihadists. You think if you're doing it in the name of God, you're good to go, aren't you? You know, and even on individual levels, we've all heard about psychopaths that kill people because they thought God was telling them to do it, their idea. And that's not to say, maybe there is a supreme being. But honestly, if there is, I don't think he would be too concerned about what we're doing. He'd probably be busy doing other things. I don't know.
Not my
ego. But the point, again, getting it back to karma and what the Dhamma is also, the Buddha's Dhamma, is a way of taking radical acceptance for our own life and our own well-being and not putting it on other people or even other belief systems. And that relates to, a little bit to the idea of reincarnation. If I do... much of modern Buddhism is driven by merit, but the Buddha taught merit as a way that is developed. Merit is developed through the Eightfold Path, through developing understanding. That's the most meritorious thing we can do. That's why I say the most loving thing I can do for myself and all others is to develop the Dhamma and awaken. In many other Buddhist religions, but also worldwide religions, good acts is taught as your way to salvation. Do enough good stuff for other people. And that's not to say we shouldn't, but what's the intention? If the intention for me to keep opening doors for people and being kind to people and maybe giving 22% instead of 20% as tips is so I get a good spot at St. Peter's table, that's just eye-making, isn't it? And when I die and there's no St. Peter, I really set myself up for some disappointing, haven't I? I spent my whole life doing all this good stuff and there's no St. Peter. What a jip. It's all eye-making, and it's always going to be a problem. But if I recognize it in this moment, I am responsible for how I think, how I feel, and how I act, then I will not create any more karma. I won't create the possibility of having a disappointing experience in this life. And then every moment in this life, as my life unfolds, will be meaningful, no matter what's occurring. I might get caught up in one of these awful hurricanes that we've been having or something else. It doesn't mean that, well, that's going to be a pleasant experience because I'm awakened. But it will be a meaningful experience because I'm awakened. I'll be here for it. I won't be running away from any of it. And I'm also free to experience all of the other mundane moments of life as life occurs as meaningful moments, not something to be ignored or to be avoided or to get past till there's, so there's something more exciting happening. Each moment is meaningful. Each moment is significant because there's no karma unfolding. Jen, good to see you. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you, John, for, you know, everything.
Thank you.
I like what you said, Anthony. That's really helpful, actually, to kind of I always use metaphor to kind of bring that in on a daily basis. I think would be helpful. In terms of right livelihood, you can, from a broad perspective, step back and take a look at your life and say, okay, yeah, my work is, my career is skillful. It's not hurting anyone or selling guns or whatever all the list is of right livelihood things. I can't remember them all, but there's just so much potential to get attached to your work and attached to the outcome in your day, and that is can be frustrating if you have an ego. Just your day to day kind of things just don't go the way you wanted them to. You didn't even realize you were attached to some kind of outcome. But bringing metta in the end of your day or throughout your day can kind of release some of that frustration. Thank you.
Thank you for saying that. And again, Anthony, thank you for bringing that up. Metta is a direct way in the moment to affect your life unfolding, your karma. Especially if you have a troubled mind. That's why the Buddha taught, I've been promising to teach the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the background behind it. But the Buddha taught it to a group of monks that were very disturbed in their mind for some things that were occurring in the local environment. And he taught it as a way of quieting your mind. So whenever you're disturbed, especially if you're having a difficult time in just quieting your mind during meditation, do a quick metta. That'll start ending that karma that's unfolding in that moment, just to tie it in. Eva, good to see you.
As far as rebirth is concerned, I am grateful that I now, at this point in my life, feel that I am fortifying myself with good intention to make my karma better, and it really has changed my life in such a dramatic way that I am reborn.
Hallelujah.
Thank you.
Thank you for saying that. Maura?
I was thinking when, I think before, I was before Anthony had mentioned that, but something that you had said, maybe when we were talking about religions, and I said that like snarky and bloody virgins, and I've been really kind of just watching that snarkiness appear and in myself too, and so I, like Anthony, I've been really trying to just cultivate gentleness and kindness and metta, because that idea of 20 versions comes from a
a very deluded mind, and my mind is often very deluded as well. And to have kindness around that, and particularly just in my meditation practice, I know we say it all the time, you know, hold yourself kindly and gently, but focusing on that softness, I think, takes the focus off of how is this meditation going? How am I doing? It takes it off of I'm making and places it on the like a more boundless state of non-referential. So I have found it, just focusing on that. Like I took old boats out for a nice walk this morning, and just with the walking, just repeating and staying present with that, and being kind and gentle, and cultivating that sense of it of heart, because I too find, we are bombarded, and we can. Certainly, which I have certainly cut down, like, be real mindful about what is coming in, here goes both. How much one is listening to. And I heard something recently that somebody who I really respect did not listen, let's just say, to news for 4 years, and really had some very profound insights too. So, sometimes I can, there's that feeling like if I don't know what's going on, I won't be able to do anything about it. I don't think that that's true. But I can feel that rise up. And so having deep, just compassion and kindness around that, so it doesn't become a judgment of, I should be, or shouldn't be, all those discursive thinking, mental fabrications born out of ignorance. That was snarky too. Okay. Good night.
Thank you, Maura.
Have a nice summer.
When you take the competitiveness and the need for acquisition out of our meditation practice and use it just for developing concentration, then every meditation session is useful and effective, and we don't judge it in any way. And when we're having a difficulty, thank you for pointing it out more. Use metta, because remember, metta is first addressed towards ourselves, to be gentle and kind with ourselves. And when we can bring that into our meditation practice, then we don't need to have any kind of experience or go anywhere. We can just use it for what it's designed to.
Can I just clarify the idea of, just using it for concentration? Yes. And when concentration is not strong, it's not like I'm competing against something, but it will creep in. Concentration wasn't strong. But concentration isn't strong. It's different than noticing I'm not focusing or applying right effort and all this. So that's all. I'm just trying to be really kind around that. Because then you're just sitting down. I think sitting down has its own merit.
Yeah, that's why it's so important to just do the method. You recognize you're caught up in your thoughts, come back to your breathing. It's completely dispassionate. There's no you there. That's it. That's why it was taught that way. When we start substituting other methods, we get lost in it. What's that, Maura?
I said it seems like there's one there for me.
Thank you. Lorna, good to see you.
Good to see everybody. This week I've been concentrating a bit more on my meditation practice. Jen and yourself helped me last week. And then I was ducking out at the end of the meditation because it's feeling uncomfortable. And realizing that's part of meditation, why you have to hang in there a little bit. If you're distracted, if you're wanting to creep into your life, to take the meditation and concentration away. And I kind of saw that very clearly, so I've been working on that. And also putting more emphasis on it's not my breath that I'm thinking of, it's the breath in the body. And just trying to take all referential thoughts of it being my breath away from my thinking, and I just try to observe my breathing as if my breathing was just another function of my body. Like my heart is beating, my livers are working, my kidneys are working. You know, it's just always going on, and my breathing is always just going on. And just observe it as dispassionately as that as I possibly can. So I've been concentrating really on my meditation practice. My sitting meditation practice has been a lot. And I think I've understood a lot too. Thank you, Jen.
Yeah. Thank you, Lorna. Yeah, even our association with our breath should be dispassionate. There shouldn't be any I there. It's not my breath. It's just the breath in the body. People that have had severe trauma in their life, many of them have a difficulty just being mindful of their breath, because their breath is, they usually describe, especially initially in meditation practice, that their breath is, they catch their breath. You know, it's hard to just keep it flowing. You know, and that's that tightness around ourselves. But we can do that even if we're not. We when we start identifying with, is my breath correct? Should it be longer? Should it be shorter? That's that whole, remember when we talked about the four foundations of mindfulness, there's all kinds of practices that have developed over using long breaths and short breaths and manufacturing these breaths, thinking that the Buddha taught that, when actually he taught to just recognize, however you find your breath, that's what you're mindful of. And it's always going to change. It's always going to be different. Thank you.
Can I just add one more thing?
Sure.
This was just a classic teaching. Just classic, John.
Thank you. I hope you find it useful. I think these are important stuff. Debbie, good to see you. How are you?
Good. I don't have a lot to say. I think one of the things about the eye making relates to the breath, taking it to that very essential level, was helpful. I feel like I'm just really trying to focus on that piece, the eye making, you know, like recognizing when I'm interacting with others, not necessarily in my work, which is different, the interaction is different, but in socially, in relationships, how much I have that need to be, to relate to others, to be, to make, you know, to add my two cents about my experience, to,
yeah.
You know, and I'm just kind of coming to an internal sense of peace. I'm just getting it at an essence level, not a practice level yet, how much peace there is in just letting go of that need to say, oh yeah, well I did that, you know, or oh yeah, I, you know, and just to have a sense of just listening and appreciating my environment more, and, you know, just kind of, I don't want to say disappear, because actually I'll probably be more present.
Yep, that's right.
but it's you know, it's the paradox of that, right?
Yeah.
When you let go, you get to experience others more and your environment more. Mm-hmm. And so, just really trying to take in that and work on that.
That's wonderful. That really is kind of the essence of restraint and not continuing eye making, not feeling like you always have to assert yourself, you know. And there is, you recognize the great peace that comes from that, in the moment. You know, the representation of the Buddha that was made right after somebody said, "This is what I think. What do you think?" And that's what he did. That's what I'm just kidding about that whole backstory. Sit quietly. I don't have to think anything about what's going on. You know, I can just be at peace with what's occurring. Again, it's really the whole point. How to maintain a peaceful and calm mind. That's how the Buddha described an awakened mind. I don't have to always interject myself into it or say, this is what I think it should be. You know? This is, I want to reframe what you're saying to me. Reframe.
Can I just contribute something? When sure. I went through the mindfulness training, one of the things we did was to sit there and listen to someone speaking for 5 minutes and not be able to say anything. and they did it, you know, like there were 20 of us, so they did it switching roles. So basically everybody except one person said they didn't miss the other person contributing to the conversation. But the people yeah. who didn't contribute felt the need to want to interject yeah. all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that goes on all the time. You know, a self-referential ego self is always reinterpreting what's occurring to fit its own views. You know, and we've all been in arguments that somehow we seem to get caught up in something and it's not going anywhere, but we can't stop it. That's that thing. We have two views trying to maintain themselves in something that has no meaning at all. But there we get stuck up in it. It's a great exercise. Thank you. Mary, good to see you today. How are you?
I'm pretty good. My meditation practice is going pretty well. And I'm going to go home and re-listen to this talk. And, I mean, there was a lot.
Yeah.
A lot. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it makes a lot of sense, but I still need to go over it and over it.
Yeah. Yeah, and thank you for saying just that. It took me a long time to understand the simplicity of what the Buddha meant by karma. And it really has to be seen within the context that it's taught to, in the context of the Four Noble Truths. So I should post it sometime later on this afternoon so you can listen to it. So, the YouTube video will be up right now. So. Eva, you had a question?
I just wanted to say that I'm going to incorporate that in my relationship with my husband, and we're going to actually sit down, and I'm going to let him talk for 5 minutes, and I'm going to see if he's going to let me talk for 5 minutes. That should be fun.
I'll try that with my 13-year-old daughter, see if that works.
But Eva, just don't put a condition on him letting you talk for 5 minutes, okay? That's great. Any questions on karma and rebirth? All right, we'll finish it up either next week or the week after, see where it goes. But it really is a great series of talks. It's been this series has been the most viewed videos on YouTube too. A lot of interest in understanding this, and I think part of that is because of the common misunderstanding of karma. This makes sense. You know, this is something, this understanding of karma, we can actually use and apply it to our Dhamma practice rather than just going on in our life thinking that anything bad that happens to us is punishment and anything good is we're getting rewarded. You know, it's all just eye making, isn't it? So, all right, we'll finish with metta as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And these are the Buddha's words from metta, from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.